Hi, this is Paul. About a year ago, the algo just served this one up to me now. I didn't know that it happened. And when the algorithm served it up to me, I wanted to watch it right away. This is now Ayla. I think that's how you pronounce her name. She's been on Benjamin Boyce's channel. She's been on a bunch of other channels. She tells her story a little bit in this video. She grew up in a conservative, religious, probably Christian home. She was working in a factory, and she didn't find that work good at all. And so then she started into prostitution and discovered she liked it. And then she did OnlyFans, and now I don't know what she does, but... So she has been on the internet. So she does all this research. She does all these polls. I think she does polls on Twitter. Now that obviously isn't sort of scientific in terms of pollsters, but I'm not gonna judge that whole aspect of what she's doing. She's basically asking people about questions about sex. And she's obviously got a YouTube presence. Maybe she, does she stream on Twitch or something like that? She might do something like that. Anyway, so she's now got a whole career talking about sex, whereas sort of her claim to fame was she was having sex on the internet and she was an in real life prostitute. And so she's generally sort of been, you know, pro-sexual liberation, let's call it that. And so when I saw her paired up, and Unheard does a lot of very interesting, good pairs. I really appreciate what Unheard is doing. When they paired her up with Louise Perry, I thought, oh, this could be very interesting. Because Louise Perry, of course, has written that book, The End of the Sexual Revolution. And so, and Louise Perry comes at these conversations very well informed in terms of feminist ideology and all of that. So I thought this could be very, and it was a very interesting video. But when I saw the video right away, I've seen a number of conversations like this. And initially, I always pause and say, okay, well, what's really the goal here? Because usually what happens on the internet with these kinds of conversations is you have this sense of participation in an arena. And you sort of have these battling principalities and spirits that are going back and forth. And the conversation is presumed to be something like, well, one side will win and then, but then, and what? Because there's no serious conversation to, let's say, roll back the sexual revolution. Now, some of you probably caught the live stream this morning that I jumped into. I was about ready to start recording this video, and Luke started recording a video about the ritual video that I made about Jonathan Peugeot's video. And I was very curious to hear what Luke had to say. And so I jumped on there, and Yosef jumped on, and Chad, and a whole bunch of others. And Yosef started talking about law and ritual. And that question about law really made me think about this video, because one of the things, even though people love to have sort of traditionalist versus liberationist debate back and forth with respect to these things, I don't anticipate any new American legislation with respect to what consenting adults do together. This has, so there's sort of this level at which these conversations are happening, but in terms of the legal sense, there's easily a consensus in America that if you want to sort of ruin your life with bad sexual practice, you can do it. The country will let you. And when it comes to paying for sex, or at least being paid to do sexual things, the internet has been just a massive explosion of opportunity for people now who sort of want to try their hand at this. And that's the OnlyFans thing. Now this was on before Israel and Gaza blew up the news cycle. The Russell Brand thing was hot for a minute. And Mary Harrington was on Unheard with, I think this guy's name is Freddie. Mary Harrington was on Unheard with him. And Mary Harrington, she's speaking at the ART conference in London. I'm super excited to, I hope I get a chance to shake her hand and meet her in person after I had such a wonderful conversation with her. But she said something in this conversation that I didn't forget.
Style yourself as a reactionary feminist. There is something quite unusual about the mood when discussing these kind of sexual crimes at the moment. It's, at least it's unusual historically. It hasn't happened before. You might say that it has happened at previous, more religious moments.
Now, again, they're talking about Russell Brand and how Russell Brand was getting famous and in some ways sort of backwards celebrated a few years ago in the UK. And then, of course, some of these women have decided to press charges.
In history, but what's your overall feeling about today's attitude to these kinds of sexual crimes?
Very confused. My attitude is that our collective view is wildly dissonant. I mean, I think it appears to be more or less completely normalized now for adolescent girls to follow the Instagram to OnlyFans pipeline, for example. Yeah, they start
and Mary, nobody has a way with words like Mary, the Instagram to OnlyFans pipeline for young girls. And she talked about normalization. Now, Grim Grizz has often talked about normalization with respect to pornography, with respect to the Friends episode with Joey. And I've noticed, and once, as so often happens, once somebody sort of names something, then you begin to see it. And Grim Grizz has sort of said, yeah, this normalization itself is a huge issue, because what there are in society are norms and stigmas, and there's this whole matrix of social approval of either status gaining for conforming with norms or status losing for violating norms. In a sense, even though this whole status and this whole area of status and shame often sort of gets critiqued in society, part of what Grim Grizz and I think Mary Harrington are pointing to is that these dynamics in society protect the unwary, okay? If you think about the Book of Proverbs as sort of a handbook for young men, for ancient Israel, teaching, giving them wisdom, basically cluing them into the fact that if you do these things, you'll probably succeed in life. And if you do these other things, they're very dangerous and you may, in fact, be in trouble. I mentioned in the live stream, I've started watching this show Lioness by Taylor Sheridan, who did the Yellowstone series. And in this episode, the daughter of the protagonist is in a car accident. And in the hospital, as she's recovering from the car accident, it's discovered that she's pregnant and she's 14. And her father comes to her and says, now you remember that I told you there were two things that could completely derail your future. One was cars, getting in to a car with a teenage driver, and the other was letting boys in your pants. And now you've broken both of these rules. And now you're going to see the consequences on the other side of it. And so what Mary Harrington is saying is that there's been a normalization in the culture. When Russell Brand gets gets celebrated for doing all of this shagging and everybody's sort of yuck yuck. And now, as Mary Harrington says, that suddenly we were celebrating him a few years ago, and now we're going to throw him to the lions because of what we celebrated for him 2 years ago. And so anybody paying attention to the culture is going to be confused. Because on one hand, and I've made this point in other videos, on one hand, the ascendant narrative of the culture is liberationism. Liberation, liberation, liberation. But then you have this other sort of tyrannical left element of the culture that is no, 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 no. No, no, no to all kinds of things that used to be okay. And so people watch this and they're sort of confused. I mentioned that a number of years ago in the mid-teens when I started seeing change in the Christian Reformed Church, I began to think about this. I'm thinking there's a real sea change going on, but it's subtle now, but it's going to grow. And so then there was a website called Everyday Feminism that had sort of popped up in media feeds here and there. This is before I was even watching YouTube. And I thought, well, Everyday Feminism, why don't I go there and see for myself what Everyday Feminism looks like? And it was all this woke stuff. And the more I read the site, I thought, my goodness, the amount of no that's going on in this site is just intense. But it's almost as if the liberationism and the no are, they're going up together, but they're with different things. And it's so, yeah, you're looking to pass society as repressive. Well, you're just repressing, but in a very different way.
Dot out. My attitude is that the our collective view is wildly dissonant. I mean, I think it appears to be more or less completely normalized now for adolescent girls to follow the Instagram to OnlyFans pipeline, for example. Yeah, you know, they start out posting semi-naked pictures themselves on Instagram. I mean, there's a well-documented ecosystem of child erotica consumers and keywords and algorithms that recommend such content of that kind to enjoyers of such material on Instagram. And a great many of these girls who just do it for the fun and the likes and the interaction on Instagram then conclude that, fine, well, I might as well get paid for it on OnlyFans. And then, and boom, all of a sudden, aged 18, they're cam girls. And the world, you know, we seem to tolerate this, and we don't seem to view this as a sort of, you know, mass digital child grooming. And yet a story like, you know, the pseudonymous Alice recounted in the Times report on Russell Brand, who was 16 when he was approached, when she was approached by Brand in Russell Square, and who then had a 3-month reportedly abusive relationship with him, where various unpleasant things happened to her, is treated as horrific. And I'm thinking, how are we making sense of this cognitive dissonance? I think we're very confused about sexuality. We're simultaneously, I mean, I was reviewing my go-to cursed sex education book for teenagers from the American culture wars this morning, which I treat as a sort of reference for exactly these kind of cognitive dissonances. And I was reviewing what it had to say about virginity, and it essentially said that virginity is not a thing, because you can have, so there are so many different kinds of first time that, you know, just sticking to the cis heteropatriarchal one of penis and vagina sex is neither here nor there, and therefore there's no such thing as virginity, and therefore you can't lose your virginity, and therefore there's nothing, implicitly there's nothing special about sex. But it follows from this that you might as well be having it whenever and wherever. And I think this is which leaves,
and that's exactly what Louise Perry talks about with respect to the disenchantment of it. Well, now it's no big deal, and if it's no big deal, then it's no big deal 360 degrees. And if it's no big deal 360 degrees, then in fact, if one of you thinks it's a big deal because you've been a victim of what someone else has done, that's your problem. I don't know why you're so bound to these traditional ideas. You should be completely liberated. And what liberation looks like is complete disenchantment, and so it's no big deal.
Girls such as the pseudonymous Alice in an invidious position because they can't say that anything was done to hurt them. After a potentially abusive relationship, provided within this particular rubric that it was consensual, which is, when it's boiled down to something so transactional as consent, it's very difficult then to find ways of articulating the intuition that I think a great many people still feel, that in fact consent just isn't enough, and in fact there is something special about your first sexual experience, that there is something distinctively vulnerable about young women, and that there is a distinctive pattern of sexual predation and sexual vulnerability between a certain subset of older men and very young girls, that ought to be paid special attention to. And none of this fits within the received liberal paradigm of how we approach and normalize and legitimize and celebrate sexual liberation, which makes responses like this extremely confused, and I think probably also contributes to the pattern of general hand waving interspersed by periodic witch hunts.
So this
general hand waving interspersed by periodic witch hunts. Now, often with conversations like this, if you want to know a little trick, start at the end of the conversation, sort of memento style, and work your way backwards. Because often with a conversation, they don't really get to finding out who each other is and figuring out enough and getting enough trust to finally be able to be sort of disclosing of oneself in a conversation like this until it gets to a certain point. Now, where I want to start is where sort of Ayala lays her cards on the table and says, "What's this about for me? I'll tell you what this is about for me."
And Ayala, do you feel that you're an agent of change in this kind of peak of the sexual revolution or this new revolution that Louise is talking about?
An agent of change. I feel like I just want to defend people like me. Like, it feels like especially in recent years, it's been increasing. It feels like I'm like fighting against this push of women, people who feel like they're like disrespecting me because solely of my sexual promiscuity and like the way that I like to approach sex. And it feels like there's like more shame and judgment about it, like growing. I don't know if it's just because I'm exposed to different places of the internet or if this is actually a movement, but I feel like really protective of it. I'm like, no, like this is, I am okay the way that I am. And I really want to give that message to anybody who's like me. I like to be like, living like me, it can be a wonderful, healthy and fulfilling thing. And you don't have to feel shame or like you need to hide. And so if there's people like me out there, I really want to take a stand and have like a bold, unapologetic ownership of that. And that feels like the thing that I'm fighting for.
Well, that feels like a great place to end.
Okay, so she is an activist, and she's an activist for people like her who are promiscuous and don't want to feel bad about it. Okay. And other people make her, first she said women and then backed off. But yeah, I mean, part of, there's a conversation between myself and Laura in the members only section. It's in the $3 a month member only section. So it's, Jess didn't know that there were levels. There's sort of a supporter level for 25, and there's a no wait, no ads level for $7. And then there's just a regular membership level for $3 a month. And I had a great conversation with Laura in there. And in that conversation, Laura basically says, you know, women basically create the terms of a culture. And that makes perfect sense when you think about femininity and its arenic quality, and they do. And so it doesn't surprise me one bit that Ayala feels pressure from women. Now, this would be for whole ranges of reasons. If she's having sex with their husbands as a prostitute, if other women's husbands are looking at her online or supporting her on OnlyFans or supporting her on Twitch, well, other women are going to have thoughts and ideas about this, and probably they are not going to like it. So it's very interesting the way this thing goes. And again, as Mary Harrington noted, and supposedly this, you know, we're on this sort of progressive track of liberationism out and out and out and out. And suddenly someone like Louise Perry comes in and says, you know, I don't think it's quite happening the way it is, because this pipeline from Instagram to OnlyFans, that's probably not serving a lot of women as much as what they think it should. Okay, now we're going to go back another step through and listen to where this goes.
There used to be quite a high barrier to entry for sex work, if you're talking about street prostitution. Whereas now, with things like OnlyFans, the barrier has been lowered massively. Is that a good thing?
So the Instagram to OnlyFans pipeline,
that more and more people have access to a potential sex work career.
Yeah, I mean, like, I know like a bunch of single moms or women with health issues, like women who like are struggling to like feed their kids on their own, who said, oh, I tried OnlyFans and it gave me not even that much money, like an extra $300 a month, but like now I can pay my rent. Like, there's a whole bunch of people.
What's interesting would be if they could maybe earn $300 a month with their clothes on, would they opt for that instead? My guess is that most of those women probably would opt for that. In Sacramento, there was a situation where there was a woman who was doing OnlyFans, and she was making a lot of money. She was making enough money so that she could put her children in a very expensive Catholic school. And then some of the other mothers, and it's usually women who fight these battles. If you ever listen to Bill Maher, Bill Maher's talked about porn forever. And his complaint is always that, you know, what's the problem with women in porn? Why do women get so upset at porn? Think about it. And so this woman was making a lot of money on OnlyFans, supporting her boys going to Catholic school on it. And her boys got kicked out of Catholic school because she was doing OnlyFans. And it was probably the moms of the other boys that were leading this charge to get her kicked out. And so, okay, maybe they're making a little extra money. And so, you know, you anti-capitalist, conservative, traditional sexual lefties out there, why are you begrudging these women their extra $300 a month?
People for whom their lives are really drastically improved by not that amount of money. Typically people who are really disadvantaged in some way. Like it disproportionately assists like the poor or people like I would consider to be lower class, people who like were culturally sort of like priced out of the better paying jobs, which is why I think this worked for me so well. Like I grew up.
So people who, because of they were marginalized, disadvantaged, you can use all the words, didn't have access to better jobs. So they can get naked on camera in front of the internet and make extra money. And, you know, and this is progress. Okay.
Very, very conservative, no access to education. And so a lot of people are like, oh, well, you should just like go to college and get an education and then get a job. I'm like, for some people, their lives just don't work like that. And for some people, like being able to have easily accessible side income that you don't need training for or like the elite approval or like credentials is like incredibly beneficial and life changing. And I've known so many women for whom this is the case.
I take that point, although I do think it's worth emphasizing the fact that the drug and alcohol addiction is extraordinarily common among sex workers, right? Like not necessarily the only, like the OnlyFans end of the spectrum is clearly, I think we all agree, the much less dangerous, traumatic end of it. But that it's also not, you know, representative of the whole spectrum of sex work, some of which is dire. And it's very, very common for women to end up taking drugs and using alcohol as a way of dealing with the emotional fallout of prostitution. And that means that you're not actually ending up in a better situation at all. You end up potentially spiraling downwards and getting stuck. So, I mean, I completely take your point that there are other forms of work which are dreadful. I think that I'm not really a radical feminist at all. I think I can comfortably speak for radical feminists though, in that they tend to be very like left wing on matter. They don't think that any woman should be in a situation where she can't feed her children unless she's doing sex work. I mean, I think we're all.
And the left wing would basically say the government should give her money to feed her children so she doesn't have to take off her clothes in front of the internet.
Completely in agreement on that. I do also recognize that we live in the real world and there are situations where that might seem like the best option. I mean, the other problem, of course, being that until you've actually started, because sort of lay people's understanding of the sex industry tends to be very poor, it can be very difficult to know what you will, how you will find prostitution until you've actually done it. So saying at the outset, I think I'm well suited to this, I think it will be fine. You know, I've read through my checklist of warnings and I think it's fine.
It's not like you go to the job fair and here's the booth for sex work. Well, we don't really have a job for you. Well, we've got some pimps over there that you might want to talk to, but there's this internet and there's, you can sign up for OnlyFans and et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't work that way. Oh, just be careful because you might not feel the same about yourself after you do this kind of work. And men might look at you differently after you do this kind of work. And
isn't actually quite the same as actually doing it, because as we've been talking about, you know, sex has this kind of very visceral effect on people. It's very, very emotional. It can be very hard to rationalize it or even to have insight into your own, you know, your own emotions, your own desires. I think this is particularly true when people are young. Young people are much, much more susceptible to.
And, you know, there's another aspect to this that they're not talking about, which is that they do talk about the fact that most women who get into OnlyFans won't make much money. And so just like sort of YouTube and all the social media thing, it's like, it's not really a bell curve. It's just sort of like a zhoop, getting off of zero is hard. And well, you're better off if you're young, which means you don't really have a lot of wisdom yet. And obviously it helps if you're very good looking and desirable and attractive and all of these things. And so what if you're not any of those things? What if you're not young? I mean, for a while there were a bunch of people living in Arizona who were making YouTube videos about living in their cars. I was watching these videos for a while. I just found it fascinating and found that there are a whole bunch of senior citizens, many of whom were divorced and they're living in their cars, and they're in their little community. People are like, you know, if you, you can kind of make some money off YouTube if you sort of take videos of your life, and people are kind of fascinated by it. And so, well, there they were. And I'm sure they did a little bit better, because at least they weren't going to get any money for taking their clothes off. And men could do it too. And at least they'd get something. But my guess is that just a handful of these people living in their cars in Arizona trying to make ends meet actually did very well on AdSense at all on YouTube, because the truth is that, you know, in terms of monetization, in terms of AdSense, I get about $1 per 6,000 views. So, and you just gonna do the math sometime if you're looking at my channel to figure out, oh, Vanderclay's rolling in the dough because of the membership thing does a lot better, even though YouTube takes 30%. But so, yeah, even so, this idea that, oh, down on your luck, do an OnlyFans, you'll get rich. Well, that's what people think. But what are the costs of this?
To groupthink, to influence from other people and so on. So I think that, you know, it's going back to, like, yes, I agree, there are some situations where I can see it being the best decision for someone. The problem is that when you make a move towards normalization, destigmatization, and presenting this as a perfectly valid career route, you are going to end up with people going down that career route for whom it is an absolute disaster and it ruins their lives. And they might not otherwise. If it was...
There's the thing about normalization. That, again, this is what, you know, normalization means that large numbers of people will try it out. And one of the things that goes through this conversation a number of times is that Ayala might just sort of be at the end of a particular personality spectrum. And there were comments in the comments section that basically said, yeah, you think this is working for you now. How are you going to feel about it 20 years from now? And, you know, I saw this video on Friday, and so I had a chance to think about it over the weekend. And, you know, I thought about the exchanges that someone like me makes in terms of, I was 25 and my wife was 22 when we married, and we have 5 kids, and I saw a meme this morning on a YouTube short.
Every time my wife and I have sex, I take a dollar and I put it in an envelope next to the bed. At the end of the year, I take that money and I get her a Christmas gift. So far this year, I've made enough to get her a McDonald's McChicken sandwich.
I don't know if these shorts are going to make it through the YouTube algorithm filter, but
I wasn't presented to them as the new legitimate thing. They might not have done it. And I think that's the trade-off that we're dealing with here, and it's a really difficult one.
Well, one point I wanted to make is that there's a lot of, like, talk about, like, alcohol and drug stuff with sex workers, which I agree is true. They have, like, much higher rates of drug use. But also, like, if, say, we have a world where we, like, dramatically criminalize something like plumbing, like, plumbers are really stigmatized, and if you plumb, then people are like, I'm not sure I want to date you. We have a bunch of laws about it, and if you get assaulted as a plumber, like, you can't go to the police, otherwise they'll put you in jail. I would expect to see in this kind of case that the kind of people who would gravitate towards plumbing are people who are unsuccessful in other aspects of their life, or, like, unable to make it in, like, standard life, and probably have a lot of overlap with drug and alcohol use. Like, my guess is that this use just comes out of basically a correlation effect, not necessarily causation.
Although we see it in countries which have decriminalized or legalized sex industries as well. I mean, I think that I agree with you that clearly the stigma makes all sorts of things worse in all sorts of ways. But also, I'm not convinced that the stigma is an after effect of the law. I think that actually the stigma seems to stick to the sex industry across time and place. And I think it comes back to this problem of, you know, the sociosexuality gap requiring a prostituted class of women. Most women don't want to be in that class. It's very hard to persuade anyone to think that
most parents don't want their daughters in that class
isn't, you know, a bad outcome for those women, and the stigma flows from that.
A lot of this feels like it's coming out of, like, I think, like, I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but, like, part of me like has a resistance to it because it feels like you're sort of implicitly telling women that they should feel bad for these things in some way. Like I wish I could.
Now you can see why I played it in reverse, because a little later she'll basically say, this is why I'm fighting this battle.
Hear more like, yes, yeah, some women are like that, and if you're not, it's chill. But like I think that like the stigma is the thing that creates a lot of people's like drug and alcohol issues here. But maybe not entirely, but like generally to a very large degree. And when we talk about the narrative that like sex is extremely meaningful, that makes sex meaningful. Like we create the meaning in sex by discussing with this amount of weight. Like when women try prostitution, for example, like when you were talking about it, I was like, well, you should just like try it once or twice and see how it works for you. And if you don't like it, then stop. And this to me seems like pretty fine. And if you have.
But she already talked about the economic system. In other words, you should try it once or twice, and then if you don't like it, stop. But yeah, but the reason you got into it is you needed an extra $300 for your family. And so if you decide to stop, you still haven't addressed the $300 thing. And generally speaking, if there was another avenue besides prostitution where you could make the $300 and not have to sleep with other men or take off your clothes, you probably would have done that. And in fact, if you're not of a class where anybody is going to pay to have you to see you naked, which most of us, I'm going to be gentle with you now. Most people don't want to see most of us naked. Just saying, it's the truth. So again, Louise Perry is leaning in and basically saying, sex work is sort of a work of last resort. Well, if it didn't have the stigma. But now, again, we're back into this unreality of disenchanted sex. And if you go back to that unreality of disenchanted sex, then suddenly all of the other fights you want to fight, Russell Brand is a monster, yada, yada, yada. Oh, so you're saying sex is meaningful. And what makes sex meaningful? Because ironically, the meaning of it is attached to all of the enchantment and all of the possibilities that go into the future.
Have like a bad experience, it doesn't seem to me like it needs to be traumatizing. But if we treat it with this level of like gravitas, then it's going to create that trauma in people. And I wish that like when I was in a really sex negative culture, I could have heard more messaging about how it's like okay to be sex.
So now, in a sense, she's saying, I wish I could have gotten into the industry sooner.
Actually, promiscuous if you want to. Like if I had like been surrounded by, you know, people giving me like the kind of message that you're giving me, I think I would have ended up with a lot more shame and guilt.
I know plenty of people who involuntarily and now the voluntary thing is important, but most of those people I don't hear being very grateful about the age of their introduction to this aspect of human life. Many of those people spend way more than, many of those people spend thousands of dollars a month trying to process what had been done to them.
Overall,
I acknowledge that it can seem condescending and judgmental, the kind of the anti-porn, anti-prostitution feminism, but you know, we all know that the real, like the really brutal attitudes towards sex workers come overwhelmingly from sex buyers, right? Like if you look at any kind of like review platform where men will describe their feelings towards women they buy sex from, they have, I mean, I'm sure there are exceptions, but we know that men who buy sex are more likely to be sexually aggressive, more likely to admit to rape outside of the sex industry. You know, this is, I think that the effort to, I think the problem with the effort to destigmatize and kind of hope that after that we will somehow kind of arrive at a sex industry that really is just like any other industry, is that it is basically based on theory. It's based on faith that all of this, that the stigma is causing the problem, not the stigma is attached to the innate problem, which is actually has much more to do with the fact that most women find prostitution very distressing and most sex buyers don't treat the women they buy sex from with proper respect.
So just looking at society as a whole.
This next section deals with technology, which is also quite interesting.
So what about these sex robots? I mean, that's certainly not what God intended, but it's a lot safer for everyone involved, isn't it?
But are we optimizing for safety? Like, I'm down, like, there's ways to optimize for safety. So sorry, there's a lot of points in here. One, like, sure, I like the idea of sex robots existing. I think, like, if men can have, like, an outlet that they need that is affordable and accessible to them, this seems good. I'm, like, generally pro people independently pursuing what they want. And if that's sex robots, then go for it. I'm not really too worried about this having like impacts on things. Like I did a study just recently with 20,000 men and found that like the amount that they watched porn and the types of porn they watched was like basically not correlated with anything else I tested. Like very, very.
In other words, she's on the porn is harmless side of the argument, which doesn't seem to be...
minorly, which was very surprising to me. Lots of people that argue that like porn use, and so it is correlated with things. And so my guess, like my intuitions based on this, is that like widespread use of sex robots would also not significantly impact things. But I don't think we have good.
This is amazing to me, because over in other areas we have conversations about population collapse. We have conversations about marriage rates going down, the abandonment of marriage by men, and conversation we had, you know, women gatekeep sex, men gatekeep commitment. And, you know, from a lot of what I see, a big part of the problem with men right now is if you continue to lower the cost of sex, women are going to get less and less commitment. And now it's interesting, a little bit earlier she talks about the fact that she had many male clients who weren't getting any sex from their wives, and so they reached out to her, but you know, they of course kept it quiet because they knew full well that if their wife would find out that they were going to a prostitute or were paying someone via OnlyFans or. And the men don't want to go there because the men have lots of other things that they really care about riding on the relationship. And so this perspective that, well, this is all harmless, I think it just seems so completely naive and myopic with respect to when I talk to people. Well, if we just took away the stigma. Part of the reason people are so they're so guarded about their spouse's sex life is because they understand that in many ways the sexual attraction and the flirtation and the courting is all sort of just the beginning stages of much larger relational commitment levels, which means that, oh, I don't care if my husband is always getting something on the side. Oh, well, do you care if your husband stops bringing home money for you and your children? Well, those things aren't connected. He can have sex on the side as long as he sort of keeps bringing home the money. It's sort of the mob boss's wife's trade-off. Well, I know that he's involved in prostitution. These things, just watch The Sopranos. And you can watch that. You can watch that dynamic. The problem is, of course, that what women are really in a battle of, and of which sex is a part, is attention. And so if the man starts paying attention to other sex partners, probably the man is going to start paying attention to, well, of course, the pill is involved here, so there would be the progeny of other sex partners if those relationships are in fact fruitful. And historically, it makes perfect sense why women would be jealous for the attention of their spouses, because where the attention goes, there goes the money, there goes the resources, there goes the commitment. And in longer-term marriages, then suddenly there goes companionship, financial security, a future, all of those things. And they're all attached to sex. Sex is sort of the head of the spear. symbolically speaking. But the rest of the shaft follows. I'm sorry. And I think her point here is naive, that men will simply be going, you know, sowing their oats in all of these other fields, and they're still going to be committed to their children. Ask anyone who's, not anyone, but probably most of the people, well, why wasn't Dad around? Well, because basically the heart of it is Dad and Mom didn't get along, or Dad lost interest in Mom, and so Dad decided to chase someone else, and so now Dad has relationship 2, 3, 4, 5. He has children with some of those other relationships, and I'm down the hierarchy. And Dad said lots of nice things about, I'm still your dad, but now Dad has all of these other kids with different women, and now suddenly Dad not only has to maintain relationships with these other children who are living in distant households, he has to maintain some relationships with the mothers of those other children. And so very quickly, children find that they get ever increasing tiny slices of fatherly attention the worse this goes. But of course, this is all fruitless sex that they are talking about for the most part here. And so what could be the damage?
Good data on this. So I don't have like very strong intuitions in any direction. It's mostly like, I'm not sure. We'd have to like do a study or like interview a bunch of people to sort of find out how this is impacting them.
So do you think that...
And part of the problem, of course, with interviewing people is then you just get what people say, and you're not interviewing his girlfriend 10 years ago who he had two children with and the amount of attention those two children have gotten since he's three girlfriends out down the line. Oh, but these people shouldn't have children. Oh, okay. Well, who will?
The skin-to-skin contact, as you said there, is superior to this kind of digital sex work that we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's like, it's just, it feels really dehumanizing, like I said, for both parties. With like OnlyFans, I'm not dealing with a man, I'm dealing with the collection of men.
And what's amazing is that before, this is a way to get $300. Now, remember, I'm going backwards through the interview. Well, it's really dehumanizing. And of course, if you understand the flow of the interview, okay, it's really dehumanizing. No, but it's an extra $300 a month. Well, let's see, how many hours would that be at McDonald's? How many hours would that be waiting tables?
I'm dealing with like the statistical likelihood of man clicking on this thing. It's very robotic. It's like I'm just treating men for like the money they have to offer. And similarly, the men, this is encouraging men to treat women the same way. Like you have like a billion women and it's sort of just like cycling through them. You're not really developing a relationship with any of them. And again, I am pro people pursuing what they want in their own time. I'm happy OnlyFans exists. But I know
we can normalize anything. That's okay. We're simply not going to worry about where it goes.
Notice it was much better for my mental health to do it in person. It just felt so much better and more fulfilling to be able to touch an individual person.
Are we suggesting that it's sacred though? I mean, Louise, you started our conversation by talking about how sacred sex is and the act of sex. Would you say that in-person sexual contact is preferable in some way to this new digitized form of sexuality?
So I think that if you could somehow arrange it so that the only people who were selling sex of any kind, you know, let's say in real life prostitution, just for the sake of argument, were people who, you know, had a vocation, right? Genuinely didn't find it distressing, genuinely had like safety systems in place to reduce risk. I mean, we know that the risk is still extraordinarily high for sex work compared with other lines of work, but you know that there are ways of reducing risk, etc. And you know, if we could kind of, and if the only men buying sex were, you know, filtered for non-aggression and all this kind of stuff, you know, like the perfect system, then
now remember, first we're talking about mass deployment so that men wouldn't get frustrated with not enough sexual outlets. Now we're going to severely vet the Johns. We're going to legalize the whole thing. Okay, now you're going to have to qualify to be a John, and you're going to be the nicest possible John. And what, it's going to be like Richard Gere and Pretty Women, because that's the ideal. Yeah, you're going to be back with the same problem you had before, because you're idealizing all of these things and you're talking about the ideal. And the truth is, none of this is anywhere close to the ideal, because what is the ideal? It's one man, one woman for life. That's the ideal. That's the ideal because it spans intergenerationally, and the children get the maximal benefit from the father, and that's the ideal. So now we're going to try to shore up prostitution by, you know, the Grim Grizz has this great clip of me laughing because Louise Perry had this conversation with Tammy Peterson, and Louise Perry shared that what she saw in terms of trying to get all of these young men to treat women better were long lectures in Marxist feminism. And this was supposed to somehow curb their libido. Well, I'm sure it curbed their libido for the people lecturing them in Marxist feminism. But yeah, the church had been warning them of fire and damnation and growing hair on their palms and going blind for hundreds of years, and somehow now lectures on Marxist feminism and the liberation of the proletariat is supposed to, oh, that'll do the trick. And so now we're going to have this massive situation where only the best Johns get to qualify to have an escort. And it's like, what are we talking about?
And maybe the problem is that I don't think it's possible to have that perfect system, because I mean, all societies have prostitution of like varying scales. It's basically a solution to the sociosexuality gap, the fact that men are much, on average, much hornier and much more desirous of sexual variety than women are. Prostitution is a way of kind of bridging that gap by providing men who aren't otherwise getting the sex that they want access to a class of women who are like reserved for that purpose. The problem is that the prostituted class of women in all times and places are not necessarily women who are happy to be there and are temperamentally well suited to it and are safe, etc., etc. They're so much more likely to be women who are there because they're poor or because they have some other kind of like difficult life circumstance, like drug addiction or pimping or whatever it is, that means that they're forced into that situation, because there just aren't enough women who are really happy to do it to meet the demand. And this is the reason behind the Nordic model, where the buyers are criminalized and the sellers are decriminalized, in that it disincentivizes men from buying sex and therefore means that the supply is reduced because the demand is also reduced. And so you end up with fewer women trafficked in particular, but also fewer women who really don't want to be there because of other kind of coercive circumstances ending up in prostitution. So I think that, you know, I can agree that there are like perfect scenarios. The problem is that when we're talking about policymaking or lawmaking or even just thinking about like norms, we're not dealing just with perfect situations. We're dealing with reality.
Like, I think I share like Louise's perspective in that, like, I want people to do what feels good for them. But also it feels like a little unfair. Like,
I want people to do what feels good for them. I doubt she'll watch this video. Do you want me to make this video if this feels good for me, even if I'm critical of your position? That doesn't bother you at all? Then maybe it doesn't. People want people to do what's good for them unless it costs them something. Yeah, you can do anything you want with your house unless you're my next door neighbor, and then I want you to clean up your yard. This, again, it's back to this individual libertarian idea that, well, just do anything you want and as long as it doesn't hurt somebody else. But the point of this conversation, again, is the normalization of certain things and how many people are going to be hurt by the normalization of certain things. And what's amazing is that we have all of these conversations about normalization and things like that, about all sorts of things that the left just freaks out about. Normalization of racism or misogyny, or we can't have any of that normalization. Oh, okay. That normalization would be bad. Okay. But we can have normalization if we're going to destigmatize consensual sexual behavior. Okay, well, how's consent going to really work again? Because the problem is this, the way our takes on things right now, now she is about the biggest promoter of this liberationist perspective out there. And so all of this is consent. But the question is, 20 years from now, when she looks back on her life now, how will she feel then? It would not surprise me much. I'm not going to say at all, but much. If, given the fact she grew up with conservative Christian values, that 20 or 30 years from now, she goes back to those values. And then she can make YouTube videos basically saying everything in reverse of what she's saying now. And that will get likes, because people can go back and find these videos now and then listen to her then. We love a turnaround story. And so she could, in fact, just be setting up, you know, her celebrity venture for when her looks are gone. Because is she going to have a man that's going to be with her when her looks are gone? When the big thing that she sort of presented first were the looks. And again, that's normal. When I married my wife, we were both, she was actually just short of her 22nd birthday. She was 21 years old and I was 25. I just passed my 25th birthday. So, you know, I was 30, 40 pounds lighter, had a full head of hair, you know, went on to have 5 kids. Yeah. But now, you know, we look across the room at each other and we smile. And she's still drop dead gorgeous. I think so. And we enjoy time together. And, you know, our hope is that we, till death do us part. And that, you know, our 5 children together, there's no stepkids along the way that are competing for attention or resources. That's the ideal. I should be fair and let her continue to make her points.
If a lot of the radical feminists had their way and got to protect women against sex work, I would have had much worse options when I was trying to escape, like, the factory work. I wouldn't have had that option. Like, it wasn't my first choice. I didn't want to do it, right? Like, I was not happy about it. I was, when I first went into it, I was, like, really, like, embarrassed and humiliated. I would have rather done that than any of my other options. And so, like, the idea of, like, removing this, I'm like, okay, like, I get that you're trying to remove an embarrassing and humiliating option, but if somebody's going to that option, it's because it's the best one out of their other options. And I'm like, I don't know how to convey this with enough strength. Like these people are making choices based on what's available to them. And it's like only from the outside where you're like, removing the amount of choices you have is better. I do agree that this is good if the choices are misrepresented. If people are consistently like, I think sex work, I'm going to make a bunch of money and it's not going to be distressing.
How do you fairly represent it to people? Because you can't. Because there are these things in life that you cross, these boundaries that you cross, and, you know, like being a soldier. Well, I'm going to go into the army, and you know, you have this every time there's a big blow up, and, you know, Israel has it right now, and America had it with 9/11, and I'm going to go into the army and defend my country, and you're all full of that enthusiasm. Well, 4 years later, do you feel the same way about being a soldier? You might still say, no, it was the right thing that I did, but you're lots more sober about it because you can't know that at the front end, which is exactly Louise Perry's point.
At all. That I would be like, okay, we should have more education about, like, what actually is involved. And this is true for me. Like, when I talk...
And it's always education is the solution.
Talk about sex work. I'm, like, very clear. Like, in my articles about how to do sex work, the first couple paragraphs have these are the downsides. Some people cannot mentally handle this. Please be aware and evaluate if this is actually right for you. And in my opinion, this is the way that we should, like, preface things. But then also, like, trust people to make their own decisions about it.
But she also got finished making the point that it was the best of all possible alternatives because all the other ones were bad. So on one hand, you want to sort of, again, have sort of the job fair approach. Well, here's sex work over here. Here's being an administrative assistant there. He's this, this, this. Well, people only do sex work if it's sort of the last best option. And number one, if they're at least attractive enough to be able to do that, which already cuts it down to a small part of the population. And I mean, it's just inconsistent the way these two arguments go.
But yeah, the access to sex work, even when it's shitty, is still better than anything else, like if you're taking that option.
There used to be quite a high barrier to entry for sex work. You're talking about street prostitution. Whereas now, with things like OnlyFans, the barrier has been lowered massively. Is that a...
All right, we played this already. Okay, let's work this disenchantment angle.
The problem with trying to view sex as not having any kind of special status is there are all sorts of effects downstream of that, which I think are really unwelcome and are particularly really unwelcome for women. So I think that the sexual disenchantment, you know, it's largely a rhetorical move. It's largely, a way to kind of affirm liberal ideas about sex in the post-sexual revolution era. And it's, you know, the problem is that the fact that people do viscerally feel that sex has some unique status is quite difficult to rationalize. It's quite difficult to slot that into any kind of logical argument system because it's quite intangible.
If we call it sacredness, Ayala, do you think that sex is sacred?
My guess is that sex is like a greater flexibility in like meaningfulness than maybe what I'm hearing from you. Like, I agree that for some sections of the population or like sociological or social narratives or something, like sex is treated like very seriously. And in other types, it's kind of not. And my guess is that people are much more flexible along the spectrum than you might think. Like, I worked at a factory, terrible hours, and then I escaped that into sex work and eventually into prostitution. And like, from my experience, I after I did this, I was shocked that people had placed so much meaning on it in a way that prevented me from escaping like terrible jobs to begin with. Cause like, I didn't go straight into sex work because of that meaning that people placed on it. And then when I did, I was like, fuck, that meaning that people loaded up onto sex, like prevented me from living basically my best life. And I know a lot of other sex workers who feel the same way. And I'm not saying that everybody should. I also know some sex workers who...
In other words, it's super disenchanted it for her, which is completely understandable.
Tried sex work and then we're like, shit, like I can't not have the meaning here. But there's lots of like changes, right? Like you can shift from one section of meaning to the other. And so I think my problem with this is not that we're saying that sex has a lot of meaning, but rather like eliminating the possibility that we can remove that, or that for some people, this is the correct way to approach the situation. It feels also like kind of like double standardy for people to be so concerned about me as a sex worker and to be considered this to be like a reflection on my life and stuff. And the factory was horrible. It was horrible. And that was another thing that in hindsight, I also rationalized. Like when I was working at the factory, I was like, this is fine. This is my life. This is what I have to go through. And then after I got out of the factory, I was like, wow, I was actually suppressing so much of myself in order to handle this. And I think we do this all the time. We all go through the thing where, like, right now, we're living lives where probably if we got transferred to an alien planet that had, like, zero scarcity, we would look back on our current lives right now with a lot of horror. So you just mix this in with, like, social stuff. I think that this is also true for, like, the polyamory monogamy distinction. Like, you're correct in that, like, a lot of polyamory discussions are talking about, like, what jealousy issues. But, like, monogamy also has, like, dead bedroom problems, right? Like, both are relationship structures that require some sort of, like negotiation of your desires and what you can achieve in your life. And both of them have like pretty severe downsides. And as a sex worker, I see a huge amount of the downsides in monogamy from men, supposedly monogamous men who come see me because of failures in their monogamous relationships. Like it feels like my overall issue here feels like people are pointing a tighter.
What's interesting is the truth is they probably wouldn't come to her because of failures in their monogamous relationship, because they wouldn't still be in it. We're working on what we mean by failures here. I would say they're coming because of shortcomings, but they'd like to maintain the monogamous relationship, even though they are stepping out and cheating, which is why, of course, they're cheating and lying, because they would really like to maintain the relationship, and they're frustrated. And so, obviously, the relationship has issues. But if the relationship failed, they would probably go and get a girlfriend and get it for nothing.
Your laser eye at like the non-standard, non-normal, the deviant types of sexual approaches than they are at the conservative, like socially accepted ones.
So talking about your case specifically, Isla, you say there that you've got husbands coming who maybe their marriage has broken down. If you were not there to service the kind of the needs that they then had, do you think that they would turn back to their wives and...
Now what's really interesting here, if you'll notice, right here, YouTube shows the part that's most replayed, and it's this part where she talks about frustrated husbands.
And have a frank conversation about their sex life. Or do you think that you are offering them a way out?
Well, so my data set is basically, I would ask the guys that I saw, are you married? And if they said yes, then I would ask, so why are you seeing me? So I get like sort of, you know, it is like a little anecdotal here. But the general sense that I got was that most of them had wives that weren't interested in them anymore. Basically wives that had like a bunch of kids or like were, you know, had health issues, that basically just their sex drive was zero. And sometimes I would ask like, well, have you considered like bringing it up to her? Like, have you talked with her about it? And the majority of the response, I say maybe 60-70% were like horror. They were like, I don't want to destroy my entire life. One like guy, it was common for guys to be like, if I bring it up with her, I think she would leave me.
Doesn't that suggest that actually if you weren't there to counsel them, that they might actually go and speak to their wives about it? That the point is that by allowing these kind of sexual avenues by which married men can go and find a kind of proxy sexual partner, that they don't have to confront the real emotional issues at the heart of their relationships.
This is like possibly true to some degree, but like my intuition is not that this is the case. Like a lot of the men had been sexless for 10 years before finally trying to find a sex worker. Like most men don't feel great about the sex, like making their wife unhappy, like potentially to do this. Like it is pretty high cost. A lot of them are risking like damage to their life. Most guys I talked to, I got...
Okay, so they're risking... This is where the, you know, this is where the big replay moment is coming. Damage to their life. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, now, okay, well, let's play the stigma thing out again. Well, what if we destigmatized cheating? We've decriminalized it. You won't get arrested for cheating. What if we destigmatized it? What if we just didn't care? What does that serve? Does that serve men? Does that serve marriage? And especially, does it serve children? Because the argument I made before is that the reason, I think part of the reason that men or women are jealous for their husbands, men are jealous for their wives too, part of the reason that people are jealous for their partners is because they know that attention and sexual interest is a gateway to an entirely different life trajectory. And in that sense, a prostitute seems like a reasonable thing, because a prostitute, well, you're not gonna have a life trajectory with them. Oh, but what's funny is that the reasonableness of it, well, you're not gonna have a life trajectory with them because they're a prostitute, is because of the other stigmas. In other words, we, generally speaking, with these stigma issues, we used to usually like to say, well, stigma is bad. Oh, okay. But actually the stigmas sort of work together in different ways in the stigma economy. So if you would destigmatize prostitution on the side of the demand side, the Johns, and you destigmatize the other, well, probably prostitution will kind of go away, but so will family life. Because what you're going to have then is a never-ending attentional marketplace. And what commitment actually does is begin to say, well, yeah, I run through it in marriage ceremonies all the time, forsaking all others. In other words, if the idea is, well, I'll be with you until a better deal comes along, that's not good for the kids. And that's not good for the partners. In other words, what you do is you make a commitment, and that commitment is bound both ways. Go ahead and look back at my conversation with Vaush a number of years ago. Because, well, let's say you get a horrible disease and are paralyzed or have dementia, and I have to stick with you? Yeah. But the opposite is true too, that if something bad happens to me, you should stick with me and we'll care for each other. I remember when my I've told this story before. When my father died, and my mother said very quickly, "And I'm not getting remarried." And my sister and I kind of look at each other like, "Where's this coming from?" And she's like, "I'm not going to take care of another old man. I gladly take care of your father, but I'm not going to get involved with another old man and have to care for some other old man for the rest of his life. You know, no thanks." Fair enough. But
The impression that they had made at least some effort. Not some of them, no. Like, I'm not gonna say that every dude was like this. Some guys were like, fuck it, like, I don't give a shit. Like, our relationship is totally separate from this, and I'm just gonna like fuck other people because that's what I want. Like, I totally admit that there were some guys like this, but it was not the majority. In fact, I got the impression that seeing these men actually like probably helped save them from divorce because like their other option was not talking to their wives, their other option was leaving their wife because they couldn't talk to their wife, right? So it was sort of like this safe, tiny outlet that allowed them to make.
And I don't want that point to go, there's the big replay. I don't want that point to go unnoticed because it is a fair point, but it's limited.
Maintain longer, more dedicated relationships.
Presumably their wives would have left them if they'd known, though. So this was
Yeah.
a secret encounters.
Yeah.
There's another big point.
Monogamy clearly has its downsides too, that everything in the whole entire world has trade-offs, right? That's like a fundamentally conservative insight. I think though that, I completely take your point that there are some people for whom polyamory is great. There are some people for whom sex work is great. There are some people who are just temperamentally much more suited to, non-conventional sexual lives and.
And this is where we get the reality check that I started talking about at the beginning of the video, where society isn't rolling back. And it's going to be very interesting to see where, in fact, society goes, because the liberationism might not win all of their points, because at some point their arguments just get stupid. But the libertarianism has tended to win. And that's probably, that means buyer beware or young person beware. And you can't sort of rest your laurels that the government is going to put down stipulations. What seems to happen in a pluralist society is that the government, in some ways, pulls back. And so, what that means is that wisdom institutions had better do a better job at preparing people. Now, I think that's it for this video. The whole conversation was good, and I hope I've been fair to all sides. But and again, a point that I want to make in many videos, it is technology that is moving this forward. And has moved this forward dramatically just in the last 30 years with the internet. And technology is going to continue to move forward, and we're going to need more and more wisdom and more communities of wisdom to figure out how on earth we're going to survive this, because technology is just sort of shredding it all. So leave a comment, let me know what you think.